a rope.
Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure on today, which is March 31st, 2018. It happens to be a Saturday, but then again, it's usually a Saturday when we're on the air. And you're welcome to give us a call in here at The Personal Wealth Coach, the radio program, at 254-773-1400, and we'll talk about whatever we need to talk about with you.
Man, there's a lot of good stuff to talk about. Oil, Barclays, let's see what else we've got here. Medical bills. So student loans, there's all kinds of good stuff, but I'm sure you have some things you want to talk about too.
Well, there's a lot of things. One of them is the fact that SpaceX got approval from the FCC to put lots and lots and lots of satellites up. And why is that a big deal? The satellites that SpaceX wants to put up, they want to put up a constellation of hundreds of satellites to provide internet access globally. And the FCC approval says they have to have half of them launched within 6 years if they're going to get approval to do this. Now, there's some other companies that are doing it at the same time, so they don't have a monopoly on it. So within a couple of years, 6 years on the outside, we'll be in a position where you no longer get into the dead areas where you can't get Wi-Fi. Now, the rest of the world is mostly a dead area where you can't get Wi-Fi, but I occasionally run into problems where I'm out in the boonies taking pictures of deep space or something to that effect, and I can't get Wi-Fi connection, and it's very irritating. I have to drive to someplace where I can so that I can continue to communicate with our business and communicate with everybody I like to communicate with. Ubiquitous worldwide Wi-Fi at a reasonable price is not very far away, folks, and that will be, in my opinion, a boon to our economy. And let me explain why. Right now, we're seeing a lot of towns dry up across the country, small towns, who have been left behind. And you can see this historically by going just a little bit east of the Temple area, Temple Belton area, to the smaller towns to the east that are not particularly ones that are not on 190, but even some ones that are. You know, Holland is a prime example. Taylor, to a lesser extent. The places that are dried up and turning into ghost towns are the places where the transportation system left them behind. Transportation, in a larger sense in economics, is actually referred to as communication, because communication lines, I-35 is a communication line. It also happens to be the place where the Wi-Fi is, and that's not coincidental. And so communication lines are critical. We got nice highways that go into Holland, but that it just dies right there. You can't make an argument beyond that because the major highways don't go there. To the degree, there's a good study that came out. I think it was in The Economist. I could be wrong. But there was a good study that came out in academic journals and then was republished in a lot of other places that indicates that I know it was in the Wall Street Journal too, that the majority of the opioid epidemic, the majority of the economic depression and unemployment and all the things that we used to associate in crime, all the things we used to associate with the inner city, is going on in rural America, and there is a direct correlation between connectivity on the Wi-Fi system and poverty in the United States. The places that have good connectivity, where you have high-speed, reasonably priced Wi-Fi available to you, where you can get to the internet and exchange data and do service work, and literally sell things, because if you're out in the boonies and you got some really good Wi-Fi, you can order something, either modify it or just repackage it, and you can sell it on Amazon or something, or eBay or someplace like that, and you can make some money. Factories and other businesses need to have high-speed internet connections in order to function effectively. If they don't have them, they move to where they can get them. One of the reasons that Austin is booming, and it's a self-feeding effect, Austin was booming and had a lot of people capable of dealing with it, so they now have a high-quality. Google went in there and put in some high-speed fiber optics across the entire city, and so most of the people in the Austin area get phenomenally better internet connectivity than we get here, even in Central Texas. So I know in Salado, we are still on the I-35 corridor, so we get some pretty darn good internet connection compared to what we used to be, but it still is spotty and it sometimes slows down. And as a result, it's not an ideal place to locate if you have a big data intensive organization. And it is put in there relatively ineffectively. If there's a constellation of satellites up there with a broadband capability at low altitude, now these are not the geosynchronous satellites that it goes up 23,000 miles, comes back 23,000 miles, and is as a result, you have a limited bandwidth, you have relatively low speed, and it's very expensive because those are big satellites. If you put up a lot of little satellites, and this is what SpaceX is in the process, is about to start doing, and some other companies are doing at the same time to a lesser extent, you have an ability to be as ubiquitous as GPS. The GPS system is available everywhere, and it doesn't get overloaded, and it works. And the same thing is true with Wi-Fi in this new system. So this is a major plus that's coming. Another thing is, and we mentioned this, I think we mentioned it last week, but it's worth, in light of the fact that we've got some longer-term, less-than-stellar reports that we made about the market, it's important to recognize that the leading economic indicators and the assets associated with them are positive. And we use my primary forecasting service is Moody's Analytics, and I really think they do an exceptional job. There's other people do it as well. They're predicting, as are all the other major analytical firms, that despite tariffs and everything else, we're going to have a healthy growth in the United States economy and a healthy market through the end of this year. And they're all doing this with high 90s confidence in their forecasting. And I think that's probably short of some blastingly unexpected event. I think that's where we are. So the and by the way, the worry factor is still plenty high.
Yeah, it's gotten higher since the tariffs, not lower. And that worry factor is a good thing. If people are worried, that means there's still money out there that hasn't been invested.
It's important to recognize the bull market climbs a wall of worry, and we're definitely on the wall of worry. And
having said that, we're in a mature bull market. But to have worry put back in, you know, the end of last year, we spent a lot of time talking about we need a correction. It's due for one. We need one. Well, we're having a double dip correction, and having the Dow down 10% twice, the S&P 500 was only down 9% the first time, 10% now. It's got a little recovery from it. But the whole concept here is now we're in a correction. This scares people. This causes people to jump out that didn't need to be in there. My thought is that this particular correction is not going to lead to a bear because we're not seeing the same kind of speed that took us down 10%. It's now we're finding kind of a resistance point where people that are going to sell probably already have.
Based on historic averages, the stock market is not overpriced at this point. It's fairly priced, but it's not overpriced.
I'm going to list some good things for the economy, followed by some resistance points.
Let me throw a couple of pieces of news in there that I want to get out.
All right.
It kind of went beneath, fortunately or unfortunately, in economic news and in national news, the president's tweets kind of blot out all the other news that is going on out there and makes it hide down on page 5 or something. The fourth quarter GDP. The last estimate from the Commerce Department was 2.5%. It got raised to 2.9%. Now, let me caveat that by saying a big piece of that was increase in inventories, which means that the Moody's is forecasting for the first quarter, this is the last day of the first quarter, and they are forecasting at this point a 2% GDP growth in the first quarter. Now, I want you to pay attention to that. Last year's average is now up to 2.6%. The final isn't in, but it's around 2.6% GDP growth. It looks like the first quarter is going to drop back to 2%. Now, admittedly, there's some seasonality issues in here, but here's the point. The tax cut was in effect for the whole first quarter. It was expected to raise GDP. The tariffs pulled it back out again, so we're going to wind up with a 2% first quarter. And here's the forecast that comes out of Moody's, and I think it's very important. We will see a recovery because the tariffs will be backed off from by the Trump administration. If they start backing down on the tariffs now that they're seeing the effect, which it looks like they're doing, by the way.
Right, right.
Then what we'll see is the economy crank up again, and it'll peak out somewhere in the third or fourth quarter of 2018, exactly in time for congressional elections, which is almost certainly what it was intended to do. Then in 2019, probably towards the end of the year, you see things start to slow down. And if we're going to get a recession,
that'd be or even a bear. The bear might predict the recession.
2020 is the late 2019 or 2020 is the time to be looking for it, because every major economic forecaster says we are running above capacity. Every one of them, there aren't any exceptions at this point. The stimulus basically accelerated the cycle.
Stimulus being the tax cut.
The tax cut accelerated the cycle. And the end result will be that sometime, and this is really, excuse me, dumb on the part of the president to support this, but he's apparently a short-term thinker. When we come up on the presidential election next time,
we're probably going to be
in a recession.
It's just the way that each of these cards has been played. It hasn't been – I mean, when you're talking about the economy, it takes a while for each thing to hit, and then the repercussions of the thing hitting. Just – if you've looked at enough dominoes falling, you kind of get the pattern, and this is what economics is all about, is that it's human reaction to other human reaction. And this is where we are. We got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hello?
Hello, caller. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach.
Yeah. It seems like you're leaving something out.
Okay.
These tariffs, I think, were a beanspring. Did administration for Trump to renegotiate some of our trade deals. It's happening with South Korea. I think it's happening with China.
It sounds like you got a lot of wind going, blowing across your microphone.
Right.
I do. Turn around. This ain't better.
It's still pretty windy, but basically what you're saying is that we're leaving out the negotiation aspect of the tariff.
Yeah, I don't think those 25% and 15% respectively are gonna stick. I think it's a means to bring people to the table and get some of this trade back into fair.
That's always a possibility. And sorry, we're gonna turn the microphone down because the wind's so loud. But I think we've got what you're asking. Is that, can we address it with you off the air? Is that fine?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Thank you
for calling.
All right, let's address it.
Right.
One of the aspects, this is an easier way to approach this. Anytime you have revenue to the government, let's just call it a tax. So the tariff is a tax. This is one of my big pet peeves about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The money from that bureau did not go to the Wells Fargo customers when they fined Wells Fargo. It went to PSAs and to the budget of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. If you're going to use the government as a fining organization, they just fined Barclays $2 billion for the lead up to the recession, overloaning, overpromising on the loans, and so on. That money's not going to go to the people that were damaged. It goes to the financial coffers of the government. That's a tax. We can call it a punishment. You can call it a fine. You can call it a tariff. It's a tax. Taxes are paid by the consumer when it's a fine on a company or a tariff. And we've got a caller on 773-1400. We'll come back to this.
Yeah, I
want to
come back to this issue.
We've got a lot to say on
of
that.
Of a negotiating tactic. And there may be some validity in that.
Yeah. Okay. Caller on 773-1400. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Nope, you're not on the air.
Okay. So when you create a tax, whether it's called a tariff or not, and then you begin to use it as negotiation for other tariffs and other taxes, what you have is the beginning of what is known colloquially as special interest groups. So when we say to Canada or to Mexico or to South Korea, this is a negotiation tactic, it's on the table, it is in essence a law, you must follow it or else. And the or else is you change the negotiation, whatever, in other areas, you start having an intense set of coding built up around a relatively simple one-page executive order. The one-page executive order now has a encyclopedia-sized, thick set of codes that go with different countries. South Korea, Canada, Brazil, Mexico, each of them has specific things that they have to meet in order to get the exemption from the tariff, and there's now partial exemptions being issued. So what we have, if it's a negotiation tactic, it is something that will impede business even if the negotiation goes better in our favor. If you start from psychologically, it is the prisoner's dilemma. It is if we've got a caller on 773-1400, if you'll just wait a minute, we'll get to you. The prisoner's dilemma says that if it's this concept that there's two people supposedly committed a crime together, or maybe they didn't. They're being negotiated with separately in separate rooms by the police, and they're told if you're the first one to rat on the other one, then you get a reduced sentence. You still get a sentence, but you get a reduced one. But the other person gets a really long sentence. That deal is offered to both people. There's not enough evidence for the police to convict either of them without one of them ratting on the other. So best case scenario, both of them maintain their silence. But there's always the fear that the other one's going to rat them out, whether or not they did it. That's kind of irrelevant. So best case scenario in trade is exactly the same thing. If we have free, open cooperation with good regulation to make sure everybody's following the rules, that's the best way to do it. As soon as you start saying this is not free and open. It's America first, or it's Canada first, or my country is better than your country long term. That's really bad for business. It's the same as if IBM said to all of its customers, we're renegotiating all of our trade to say we're going to get more money on all of our things that we're selling to you. A lot of people will continue to buy from IBM, but a lot of other people will start to buy from other companies. So that's the essence of this as a negotiation tactic. You put a bunch of resistance to trade into the negotiation before the negotiations even start.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. We probably ought to get to
that. Yeah. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing today?
Great. How are you doing?
I'm enjoying what you're saying. My thing is, I totally expect a recession, and the reason I do...
When do you expect
one? Correct. I don't know when it's going to happen. I'm not an expert like you, but I will say that I expect it simply for the fact is, it seems to me Trump is trying to retransfer wealth back to America. I mean, we have things made overseas, and now the other countries have become very strong, and now we're borrowing money from them. It doesn't seem like there's any other choice. If we want to get wealth back into America, not saying we don't already have wealth, but it just seems like we're just going to have to play dirty. That's what it seems like to me.
Whoa. Well, no, I would absolutely say not. We have been the leaders in the world in playing undirty, and we continue to be the leader in the world in playing undirty. We were at one point the only major nation in the world that said you can't bribe people overseas.
Now the
European Union has joined in with that, and gradually we're getting this place where you say you can't go around bribing foreign officials to get as
not to say bribing
law.
Or anything
no,
like
no,
that.
No, no. We're not saying
to me a tariff. Let me recorrect. I think a tariff to me, in a way, is kind of playing dirty, but I think it's necessary.
Well,
we're transferring our wealth to other countries.
No, we're not.
They become stronger.
That's the premise.
Like we are.
That is not
there's a premise. There's a premise here, and it's based on very, very old data collection practices, saying that we have an imbalance of trade with the rest of the world. That's what it says. But if this is an analogy that old Baldy here did a couple of weeks ago. If you have a bathtub, and every day that bathtub has a certain amount of water in it, and every day you are taking more water out of the bathtub than is going into the bathtub, eventually that bathtub is going to be empty. Can you imagine doing that for 60 plus years and the bathtub?
Only about 40 years.
Okay, 40 plus years and having a lot more water in the bathtub than you had at the beginning.
We've been theoretically running a trade deficit, a major trade deficit for 45 years.
The difference is
that. To me, that's what I mean. When I say transfer of wealth, that's what I mean. If we have a big trade.
No. That's the point.
We have
more wealth now than we had 45 years ago by a huge level. So if more wealth is flowing out of the country than is flowing into the country,
we'd have less wealth.
We'd be broke.
So the reality here is, and this is how I'm going to break it down as simple as possible. What does Microsoft export? Caller?
They export knowledge.
Okay. That's not tracked. People are paying them large amounts of money.
Mm-hmm. For the software.
For the software. Google exports stuff. Apple at least exports hardware. You can track that. But not the operating system, not the apps that are sold in the App Store. How about iTunes? How about Spotify? Because those are being picked up all over the place. That's not being tracked as an export,
you know,
even though it's an American product.
A car, an American automobile will not run. You know, no major automobile in the world that functions in the modern world will run without extensive software in it. The software has – there's no doubt the software has a value. When we export an automobile, that software is not counted as value.
And that's a very important factor here. We need to update some of the statistical figures to say the reality of when a statistic doesn't work, and that's the bathtub analogy. You cannot be emptying the bathtub faster than you're filling it consistently and have more water in the bathtub than when you started. So the numbers are coming back incorrectly, and this comes right to the point when the president said to the prime minister of Canada that we had a imbalance of trade there. Number one,
we didn't say we have a trade deficit, a massive
right.
trade deficit with Canada.
Right. If you look at the numbers, even these antiquated numbers don't show that. They show a surplus.
Canada has a trade deficit with us.
Even in the antiquated numbers, if you throw in the service area, all of the software, all of the electronics that are sitting in America that are being remotely used by Canada, we have such a surplus with them that it's laughable. And to use an antiquated, and by the way, the export-import numbers, the way they're calculated today, were set up in the 1930s as the method to calculate 20s. Import in the 1920s. I'm
by
sorry.
Herbert Hoover,
Herbert
Secretary
Hoover.
Of Commerce.
Yeah, before he was president, Herbert Hoover set up these numbers, and it was a big innovation because it was tracking all trade. But we didn't have software back then. We didn't have intellectual property that we were exporting.
There's a key assumption in a trade deficit.
Okay, do we have a trade deficit?
No, no, we do not. Let me explain this. There's a key assumption in the way trade deficit is reported, and that is that money is based on a raw material like gold. So if you have a certain quantity of gold in a country you're using more money to buy things from other countries than you're selling to other countries, eventually you run out of gold. But money has not been gold since 1971. So the fact is now that we manufacture a product in the United States called the U.S. dollar, which is the generally accepted currency by which just about everything else out there is priced. Oil around the world is priced in dollars. Copper, steel, aluminum, raw materials out of Africa are priced in dollars. Matter of fact, China, one of the reasons that they love to have treasury securities and they need to bring dollars in by having lots of exports is they use American dollars to buy the raw materials that they need to get from Africa because there's no other currency will work. The United States currency that we manufacture in the United States has an intrinsic value above that of any metal or any commodity. And as a result, if we bring – because we are the wealthiest nation in the world, and I know people will argue with that, but –
There's really no easy way to argue that any other way.
The easiest way to see that we're the wealthiest nation in the world, and if you're a really wealthy family or if you're a wealthy company, you will tend to buy more stuff from other people than you will sell to them if you're wealthy. That doesn't mean you're going to get broke. If you find a billionaire, you'll find out that they're buying a lot more stuff on eBay than they're selling, if they're buying anything on eBay. You know, if you look at an upper middle class family, you find out they're buying a lot more on Amazon than they're selling. Does that mean they have a trade deficit? No. What they have
is they're consuming.
They have but you see, they're also providing services that are very, very hard to measure, and they're getting paid for their time.
Another question then, you hear the political climate talking about how manufacturing is down and we need to be bringing back manufacturing.
But see, that's not true. That is that's absolutely untrue.
It is the soundbite. What is the truth here is that manufacturing employment is down.
Yeah, manufacturing.
We are at a record level of industrial output in the United States. We're just using less people to do it.
Yeah, and that's been going on since the 1950s, by the way. It has nothing to do with World Trade Organization or anything else. We're just getting more efficient at manufacturing. We automate more and more. We make more and more using more and more efficient machines.
And that's not going to go away with tariffs. If it does go away with tariffs, it means that we become a backwater because we're hiring people to do what everybody else uses machines to do.
So the issue is as far as I know, we're at an all-time record for manufacturing output in the United States. And we keep breaking that record, and it's just such a given item. We just keep on manufacturing more stuff, but we do it with fewer people. So when they say manufacturing is down, they only mean the percentage of people in the society who are working at manufacturing is down.
Okay, and this is a good way to do this. Manufacturing output by trade bloc. This isn't by country. This is by trade bloc. The United States per year, manufacturing output is about $2.3 trillion. The closest competitor is the European Union, which, by the way, is an industrialized trade bloc that has a larger population than the United States by a large amount. Their GDP is higher than us. We have about a third of $1 trillion more industrial output than they do. What about China? China's on the list. 1.45 trillion. We're at 2.3. So we are the biggest industrial output in the world, but we're employing fewer and fewer people. And that's where the sound bites get difficult, because they say industrial down. When they're talking about employment, they're not talking about output.
Yeah, I just saw that our industrial output in the first – I think it was in February jumped 11 – fourth quarter of last year, jumped 11.5%. Now, that's not annualized.
And what you saw was less people working in that sector during the same quarter. So we have less people working there and more production. And that is a normal technological shift. If we do what we did in the Depression, when people were getting unemployed and the government said, we're just going to hire them to work in the Civilian Conservation Corps. Here, you get a paycheck. Here's a shovel. Go dig a ditch. That doesn't help the long-term scenario. It does keep people from starving. So don't get me wrong there. It kept a lot of people from starving to death. That's important. I mean, nobody wants to starve to death. That's not a good way to go. So it kept people from starving, but it certainly didn't improve the prospects of the nation. It took a big war and then the GI Bill to retrain people to do things that they didn't know how to do before. Suddenly they were doing things other than with a shovel. And this is where you get to today, where industry has shifted. If we just hand them shovels or make the rest of the world have higher prices when they come to the United States, we're not fixing the underlying problem, which is in the technology and the retraining effort. We've got to take people that are being laid off of manufacturing and train them to do something that is in demand now, train them to be ready to shift to the next thing. That's something that it took government influence to do. It wasn't the Civilian Conservation Corps. It was the GI Bill. We have...
Right.
The equivalent of that today for the majority of people is massive student loans. That's not the equivalent. There's a huge cost associated with that. And it's a cost that the nation bears, not just the individual. So that those are important factors when we're talking about import-export. One, the numbers need to be updated to show real import-export, because it's not correct.
Let me give you another little issue of statistics that I think is very important. In The Economist magazine, recently they ran an interesting article. The Economist is out of Great Britain. I think it's fascinating. They ran the article, and you didn't see much about the United States. The Congressional Budget Office of the United States sat down and took a look at the fact that since 1979, there's a lot of propaganda, and that's really what it boils down to, in statistics saying that the median household income has not grown since 1979. It's flat. But what happened is the household size got smaller.
Right.
So a lot of single households with a single person in them now. So the Congressional Budget Office took a look at it and adjusted it for household size and discovered that if you adjust it for household size, the after inflation median income of an American family in the United States is up 50% since 1979.
And that's not hard to look at. You just look at the demographics. How many more women are working today than were in 1979? And that is a direct impact on the wealth of a household.
Since I can easily remember 1979, and I was an officer in the Army in 1979, so I can very clearly grasp. I was in the middle, pretty much in the middle of the middle class income in that time period. And I know exactly how well we lived and how many cars we had and a lot of things about our existence. And I look at where people in the same level of economic system are today. I say they're a heck of a lot better off than I was in 1979. I can also tell you in 1979, somebody in the poverty bracket was really feeling poverty.
They didn't have air conditioning. They certainly didn't have multiple cars.
And if you ever get a chance to go to a HUD low-income housing project where they've got apartments, and you look at the housing apartments that the low-income people in the poverty bracket are living in today.
No, it may not be something that you would want to sell your house and move into, but it's a lot better than 1979.
But they have, for example, 2 cars per apartment.
Two car parking spots.
Because they need 2 cars. And you'll see that they have a television in 3 or 4 rooms.
They have and cable on all of those televisions.
In 1979,
televisions.
We had 1 television and 1 car in our family.
And when you opened up the refrigerator in our house at that point, you would see a lot of home-cooked meals and no soda, no Cokes.
It's important to look around and say, wait a minute, does that statistic make sense? Based on my personal experience. And the fact is, the largest heavy equipment maker in the world that ran over the Japanese companies that were predicted to run over it is Caterpillar. And these are made in the United States. And addressing what the previous caller said is very important. This bargaining chip.
Right. It may be used it's been used that way in the past, and it doesn't work very well.
If you look at the price of the stock at Caterpillar and U.S. Steel and a lot of other places, U.S. Steel, if its price stays down, has the potential to go bankrupt and lay a lot of people off because of this bargaining chip, because the price of steel in the United States for the people who used it in this, if it was a bargaining chip that the Trump administration.
Yeah, that's probably what it is. His strength is bargaining.
But the point is the price of steel went up 21%, which means people who use steel who've already bid on a contract.
That price is today 21% higher than it was before the tariff.
We literally know people in the business of making things out of steel who suddenly got hit between the eyes with a sledgehammer.
People that had already made bids on a job that now have to keep to their bid, even though suddenly there's a huge price difference.
And there's a lot of repercussions. Let's put it like this. President Trump, and I'm not against President Trump, but I will say the kind of bargaining that he has done historically has resulted in 7 major bankruptcies. I don't think we can afford to do that even once in the United States.
No, we cannot afford 1 bankruptcy. Not even one. We've got to play some commercials. To avoid bankruptcy for the station, we've got to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join our conversation, the number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other side.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if today is March 31st, 2018, you're certainly welcome to give us a call in here at 773-1400, 254-773-1400, that is, and ask some questions. You know, one of the things we've been talking about is, and this is a universal truth, and a lot of people don't like it. They don't like it at all, but it's reality. When we deal with macroeconomics, which is what the stuff that politicians have to deal with, when we actually deal with macroeconomics, your gut reaction,
it's usually wrong.
It's like flying an airplane, and I used to fly helicopters for a living, and I can tell you the thing you don't do in a helicopter, particularly when you're in a crisis situation, is follow your gut reaction, because if you do, you're going to die. You instead follow what the procedures that the engineers and the physicists and the scientists have told you to follow. You follow those procedures even though they're totally counterintuitive. There have been times, for instance, when I went inadvertent IFR, which means I was in the clouds at night, when I was hanging way over on my left side, watching the controls. The instrument said the aircraft is flying straight and level, but my gut reaction, my inner ear, was telling me we were in a steep right bank. If I believe my gut reaction, I would make a smoking crater in the ground, which a lot of friends of mine did over the years. The same thing is true when you're dealing with the economy.
Or even the stock market. I mean,
that's right.
The initial reaction to seeing the market drop in most people is to sell, even though those same people will turn around and tell you buy low, sell high. Their initial reaction is the opposite. And when you're talking about macro, you get even more. You have to be a chess player. You can't be playing craps. You've got to play chess. You've got to look at it and say, what is the long-term implication of everything that I'm doing? This is, I said I was going to talk about some good things. So I'm going to.
All right. Talk about some good things. Santa Claus.
Well, non-imaginary.
Oh.
We'll just be really, really clear up front. The United States is as close to, or it's technically at the point that it hasn't been for about half a century. It is energy independent. It is food independent. That says something right there. It doesn't need to be expounded upon very hard at all. We are at a place where we don't really need, in order to survive, what the world is offering. We are providing our own energy and our own food. That's great. Not only that, we're exporting it. We're net exporters of energy, net exporters of food. That's great. That's fantastic. If you look at our ongoing innovation, that's great. Our current level of universities, fantastic. Now comes the problems. And I'm going to start. And every one that I say, you're all going to nod your head and say, yep, yep, that's a problem. Student loans. Yep, that's it. That's a problem. A lot of student loans, huge amount. It's causing a whole generation to have to work, multiple generations at this point, to have to work a lot longer to even break even than they used to. Medical costs. Oh, yeah. Yep, yep, that's a problem. Medical costs are way, way up. There's a... A recent Harvard group looked at it and said that people are more likely to not go to the doctor when they need to for fear of the cost than they have been since this survey has been done. That's a problem. It's a pretty nasty problem. If you look at so that's health. Medicare is in a lot of trouble. Health insurance across the board is in a lot of trouble. The amount of money that's being charged at the hospitals, it's obscene. So we've got some massive issues to deal with here, each of those things, and that's not all of them. Infrastructure needs to be built up. This is a big one. Prison population. Why am I bringing up prison population? Kind of a proponent of making sure people obey the law, so why would I say prison population? Well, we have the highest prison population on the planet.
As a percentage?
No.
Period.
Period.
Period and as a percentage.
And as a percentage.
Right.
China, who has a much larger population than us, has about half of the prison population, a little more than half. We're at 2.145 million people in prison. China is 1.6 million.
And a lot of the people we put in prison
are non-
We put in
violent offenders.
We put people in prison in the United States routinely for committing a crime that is a perfectly legal action in another country.
Right. This is important because when we look around and we say Russia's got a totalitarian government, they put people in prison for being for political reasons. Their prison rate is about half of ours. We've got double per capita the amount. And as a number, the Russian Federation has 600,000 people in prison. We have 2.145 million people in prison. Now, they committed a crime. Don't get me wrong there. We need to punish people for committing crimes. But we've got to look at some of the crimes that we're putting them away for. It's important to be tough on crime. We have violent crime rates that are down, probably because we've been tough on crime. But the average cost per prisoner is about $18,000 now. Multiply that out, and it's being held by the state-level stuff. So the states are paying this. Medicare, Medicaid, state-level stuff, it's just abhorrent.
Across the world, crime rates are down.
Yeah.
We're the one with the prison population up.
Right.
And the crime rates have dropped as much in Europe as they have in the United States, but they did so without putting people in prison. So we need to look at that carefully.
There's a lot of things that we can look at. Right now, we're so wrapped up in the wrong things about fixing the economy. There are ways – I mean, this is the land of the free, except that we put people in prison – for doing things that most of the rest of the world wouldn't consider prison worthy.
Yeah, for instance, it's perfect. You could do something that's perfectly legal in Colorado, come and do it in Texas.
And you go to prison.
And you could go to prison for 10 years.
And we've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. You really struck a nerve with me talking about prison population. You know, there's a joke going around in the inmate population in Texas that one of these days, Texas is just going to be one big prison.
Yeah. there's an argument in that favor because...
It is a trend line. You follow the trend line. If it was a straight trend line, it would be true. Hopefully we'll come to our senses and recognize that.
And we in Texas do imprison people a little bit faster than they do in other states, but we haven't seen the crime rate decrease. Matter of fact, the crime rate has not decreased faster in Texas than the places where they don't put so many people in prison. So this is what we call science. We take a look at something and say, well, we're putting more criminals in prison, therefore we have less crime. Well, then how is it that Colorado, for example, that puts fewer people in prison, a lot fewer people in prison, has identical crime rate drops as in Texas.
Well, they've actually got a much higher crime rate drop. And part of that is because they got rid of a couple of crimes.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking about violent crimes.
Violent crimes, yes. And their violent crime rate has also dropped. This is one of those hilarious things in my mind is that the places that have legalized cannabis, marijuana, their violent crime rate drops. It's a lot less likely for somebody smoking pot to go, hey, let's go shoot somebody up. It's just.
Yeah, you know what I don't like is, I know this is a financial show, but since you're talking about prison, what I don't like is they don't even bother to separate the nonviolent offenders from the violent offenders.
Yeah, and that's another factor. When you put somebody in prison, they're far more likely to come out a violent offender than if they were nonviolent going in. Than the general population.
Well,
result is we are creating future, when you go to prison, unless you're going to keep them there for life, you are creating criminals.
The reality is we have to accept some things. Number one, the prisons were not developed to cause people to be better citizens that have committed crimes. They were developed specifically to punish people. Any thought that they're doing anything other than punishing should be left behind for the moment. That is not the way the current system was developed. It was developed strictly to make life really difficult for people that have broken the law. And in some cases, I would say that's absolutely appropriate. If somebody's a child molester, a rapist, a murderer, a car thief, if they break and enter, they need to go someplace and get punished. But if we want them to come out and be a normal member of society, if we're not giving them a life sentence, then we need to give them some method of doing it. The other side of it is that if you're a nonviolent offender, if you were caught with some marijuana and you went to prison and it was a three strikes, you're out thing, and you were caught three times with marijuana, one, it doesn't say a whole lot about the overall thought process. I mean, if you're going out and getting caught three times with marijuana, this is not a very overly...
It's not a very intelligent person.
Intelligent. You shouldn't be doing that. If you know you're going to get caught, don't do it anymore. But come on. This is, you know, if you... Les Miserables.
Put a man in prison for stealing bread.
Right. He stole a loaf of bread. He goes to prison. We look at that and say, that's disgusting. I remember reading that as a kid and going, oh, how could people do that? That's no freedom there. And I read about the Soviet Union growing up and how if you disagreed with the party, you could be put in prison. And I thought, oh, that's horrible. They haven't done anything except to themselves or their friends when they're expressing an opinion. We've got a lot of areas that we can improve that are dragging at our overall tax rate, which in turn drags at what do we have the ability to spend on at the state level. So how is this economics? The state has a requirement to pay for education and for roads and for low-income people and for infrastructure and for security. If low-income people becomes a big portion of that, if health becomes a big portion of that, or if prisons become a big portion of that. So right now, prisons are growing in price. We've got health as a cost that's growing in price. If you take those two things, which used to be in the top 10, are now the top two You start pushing out infrastructure. You start getting rid of the ability for states to offer bonuses to business to innovate. And that's a real issue. Texas has been very proud for many years of the rainy day fund being used to attract businesses. And it's been great for our economy. But if our costs are going up because of all of these things that we've been talking about, then we don't have the ability to do that anymore. There are some real issues that the government can be working on besides tariffs, besides business taxes, to say, what are the direct results of the things we've already done? Everybody admits there's a problem with healthcare costs, but because it became a party back and forth over whether or not the Affordable Care Act was a good or a bad law, as if any law can be white or black. This was like every other law. It was sausage. You don't want to look in there. It's a bunch of ugly deal making. It was maybe more ugly than most laws. But getting rid of the whole thing is a no-go. The Democrats won't support it. Repeal and replace cannot happen. We have to fix the bill that we have, because what the president's doing at the moment is chipping away at the parts that he disagrees with. Unless we fix it, all that does is makes the parts that do work break. And yes, there are some parts of it that do work. The fact that you can have your college-age kid on your health plan is part of that law.
And the fact that if you got health insurance and you're working someplace and you have a long-term chronic condition, under Obamacare, you can leave work and buy health insurance.
Now, that was
which part, you couldn't do before.
That was part of something that Reagan wrote. So people that are looking at the whole law of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, whatever you want to call it, and saying it's all bad, haven't read it. There's a big chunk written by Republicans, just not the Republicans that were in office at the time. And we're about out of time.
I want to run one other thing by. You know, we've been talking about Bitcoin and what a bad deal it was. Bitcoin, just for the record, from its peak is now down 50%, and it doesn't show any sign of recovering. And one of the biggest, there's a couple of big issues. One is routine theft from Bitcoin exchanges, and two, finally, regulators are going to step in because they're getting tired of people using it for illegal uses.
Yeah, I was going to talk about Atlanta being taken offline, but there's a lot of municipalities that are being hit with cyber ransomware stuff. It's a big deal. We'll talk about that more later. If you'd like to contact us off the air, you can reach us locally at 254-947-1111 or 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next week, this has been The Personal
Wealth Coach. KTEM AM 1400, Temple, Texas. Listen right over your smartphone with the free KTEM mobile app.